The EMS Garage welcomes your input, www.emsgarage.com. You can interact with us via email, emsgarage@gmail.com, or you can call us at 206-984-1622. That's 206-984-1622. The EMS Garage, Episode 14, for December 12th, 2008. The EMS Garage.
Checking out right now.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. I want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. Tonight, I'm joined by Ben Denerink. I'm getting closer to saying that right, Ben?
Yeah, close enough.
Okay, all right. And you're on an ambulance in very cold Summit County. I was there today, and wow. What was it, like 12 degrees all day there? Oof.
I think it got up to 20.
Oh, man. I don't know how you guys live over there. It was like 40 at my house. Oh, that was great. I only live an hour away. And we have Skip Kirkwood tonight. Say hello,
nice.
Skip. Are you there?
Hello, Skip. How you doing, guys?
Good. Matt Solomon, fresh back from completing paramedic school, and he's nationally registered.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks, guys.
Gary Wingrove. Are you in D.C. still, Gary?
No, I'm home. Go back next Wednesday.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah, you were telling me about that. We'll talk about that here in a little bit, too.
Well, I don't think we can yet.
Oh, okay. All right, we'll talk about it maybe next week or the week after.
Yeah.
Okay. And,
hey, Gary, that's a great photo of you, by the way, on your profile.
Hey, thanks. Thanks.
He has that photo on everything that he's on, Facebook, EMS United. Oh, and speaking of EMS United, we have Joe Cavelli as our special guest tonight.
That was a nice segue, Chris.
Hey,
Joe.
I'm trying.
Thanks very much for the invitation to be on with you today.
Hey, no problem. So we have a plethora of news. We have to get to the ASEP study this week and report card, which apparently we failed miserably at as a nation. We have to get to several of the news stories today. You know, the one that it's pretty high up on EMS Responder. Maybe we'll talk about it, is the ambulance providers that were molesting people. Ugh, that just turns me off to no end. But first, we had our very first voicemail this week. So, without further ado, I want to play it for you and then give you guys a chance to comment, especially on the clinical portions that our unknown caller talks about.
Just technical difficulties.
Just dub it in.
It's dubbed
there
in.
There you go.
Okay.
Experts. A recent GEMS article states that, according to NIH studies, we're still only delivering thrombolytics to 4% of the eligible stroke patients. Patrick Layden states 20% of eligible patients as a goal, with only 10 to 15% of all stroke patients contraindicated due to hemorrhagic etiologies. Perhaps we should start thrombolizing all CVA symptom patients and avoid delays due to transports, CTs, and then transport to stroke centers. Obviously, if the patient presents with typical hemorrhagic complaints like worse headache ever, slow onset, et cetera, they should be excluded. But does TPA kill head bleed stroke patients or just guarantee them neurosurgery? Is there a study showing increased morbidity and mortality, or is it just another traditional practice we've rationalized? By the way, I love your parachute analogy against only evidence-based practice. Add to this the Annals of Emergency Medicine study showing 83% of litigation is for withholding TPA versus 17% for injury due to administration. Is the potential harm to this small subset of stroke patients worth the benefits to a larger group of patients in reducing morbidity and or mortality, kind of like reverse triage. Thanks for your time. Just another fly guy from North Carolina. Bye.
Hey, Skip, do you know him? Whoa, hey. Wow.
Can't pick up on the voice, but the accent sounds like he's local here.
You know, I am not the guy to talk about this. While I know clinical stuff, you got the ops guys tonight. I'm not sure if any of you guys feel like you want to talk about it. I was hoping maybe we'd have a few more doctors on tonight. Apparently they're all going to join us next week, but.
Well, you know, given the opportunity to talk about something about which I know nothing, I'd be happy to rise to the occasion. Actually, one reason that I suspect that the numbers are as poor as they are, that's not a clinical observation, but really a system and ops kind of thing, is that we have great difficulty in many places making a decision to transport a patient past the nearest hospital to a hospital that will offer a particular service. A few systems, now that hypothermia is out there, for example, are refusing in their communities to transport suspected STEMI patients except to hospitals with primary PCI or thrombolytic capabilities immediately available. Because of the the time issues, and I suspect it's probably even worse for strokes. You know, the politics and the economics of people who might be acutely hospitalized for a number of days, the economics mean that there will be great political pressure not to bypass one hospital in favor of the other, even if it's clinically the right thing to do.
Good point. Well, and my understanding, I mean, we have a little bit of time for neurologic versus a heart attack, but boy, I really thought most of these docs really want a CT. Although the caller brings up a good point that, okay, so we thrombolize them, but now they just need neurosurgery. What's the risk benefit analysis? I don't know.
I'm not sure we ought to go there until somebody can confirm that underlying predicate for us. An uncontrollable or uncontrolled brain bleed just sounds like really bad. that's a very significant clinical term. Really bad. There's another piece to this that kind of troubles me, and that is, what's the standard of diagnostic ability and the ability to differentiate of the typical paramedic in the United States? We still have places now, teaching somebody to read a 12-lead EKG is not that difficult. But we still have communities where the confidence level in the paramedics' read of the 12-lead EKG is insufficient, so we're once again spending money on technology to transmit EKGs to the hospital. So if the medical community doesn't have our confidence in the ability to identify a suspected STEMI based on a 12-lead EKG that we're holding in our hand, do we really expect them to have confidence in our ability to isolate with any degree of sensitivity and specificity somebody who we think is having a non-hemorrhagic stroke? Because as somebody observed just a moment ago, an awful lot of docs are going to want to scan before they make that call.
Correct.
Chris, I know this is for later in the podcast, but I was just scanning the ASAP report, and they have a question on stroke that goes, state has or is working on a stroke system of care, and 43 out of 49 states apparently say they are or do, and on STEMI, 29 of 44 states. So the appearance from the ASAP report is that states are doing better with stroke than they are with STEMI. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think I agree with you. I'm not the right clinical person to address those clinical issues he raised, but one of the things that we know is true. I don't know if there's an impact here, and I doubt anybody studied it, but the bulk of the patients that are likely to have stroke live in rural areas, and my guess is that those hospitals are a bit less prepared with resources, and not knowing how far they have to travel to a stroke center, that's probably an issue as well.
And really, should we be putting thrombolytics in the hands of people like even our service here, where we're rural, that maybe we don't see it enough to really be able to diagnose that over and over again? And the question, and maybe the caller can respond to this in the off week here, but is it because as EMS providers, stroke is still the one thing where basically we provide comfort care, we sit on our hands a lot, and we ensure that the patient has a good patent airway and we get them to the hospital quickly? It's one of the few times when the early detection and the rapid transport mean more than anything we could do in the field. You know, I even know here in Colorado that they're not at the some of the stroke centers in Denver, when they take the patient in and they find out that it is indeed a thrombolytic stroke, they'll go in with the very small type tools like they would use for going into a cardiac cath or something, going in into the brain, hopefully isolating the actual vessel and giving just a little bit of TPA right on the clot, hoping to break it up and move it on. So, you know, I'm not sure that we're that sophisticated yet as an EMS system to really allow it, but I'll let the clinical guys talk about that next week, and hopefully it'll spur some more comments. How about the newest paramedic in the crowd? What do you feel about that?
Maybe he went on a call.
Maybe he's having a stroke.
Oh, no.
Maybe he's gone, and I just don't know it. Hey, Matt, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now, man.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like my brain is mush, to tell you the truth. You guys have all said it much more eloquently than I could.
Ben, do you have an opinion?
It makes me nervous. It seems, if nothing else, it just seems like bad form to make somebody's bleed that much worse on the off chance that they have it. But not knowing the numbers or anything like that, I wouldn't venture to say anything further.
Right. Well, and even as an industry, we're not giving thrombolytics in the field for STEMI. So, I mean, maybe something should be said there, that if they don't trust us with the heart, are they really going to trust us with the brain?
Yeah, I'm not sure that would be my choice of way to frame the question.
Well, you know me, I'm blunt. I want to make sure that everybody understands it.
Well, it's not a matter of trust. I don't think as you know, do we have the diagnostic capabilities to be able to make what could be a very important decision accurately?
Okay, much better said.
Now,
same
flight
point.
Services
same point.
Giving thrombolytics in Colorado, aren't they?
Yeah, but not as normally arriving on scene of or a 911 scene. If it's an interfacility type deal, yeah.
Well, there are services that have been giving thrombolytics in the field for suspected acute MI for quite some time. And you know that one of the things we're great for doing in EMS is saying it's either good or bad. We talked a couple weeks ago, and I used the example of pneumatic anti-shock garments as one of those things where we threw out a perfectly good tool because it didn't do one small set of what it was supposed to do. but there were a number of EMS organizations in the state of Oregon back in the early 90s when I was the state EMS director there, where the nearest hospital was some 3 or 4 hours away. And some of those folks were doing lytics in the field.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because of the huge delay in getting to any facility, never mind one that could, you know, that might have diagnostic cardiology capabilities. So there was a risk benefit assessment done by the medical director who authorized it, and in a couple of cases the decision was that the harm from leaving the clot in place was greater than the harm from pushing the lytics.
Wow.
So maybe right in some cases, not right in others.
Okay. Well, let's bring it up next week, and maybe we can find some more answers in the interim. Good call, and that's what we really want on the garage, so keep them coming. Now, moving on to a not-so-great topic. Here we are again getting a black eye as EMS when maybe we really don't need it or deserve it. If you guys saw the Associated Press article from today, actually, that ambulance attendants accused of molesting patients. Basically, it says that they did some type of retrospective analysis and found that over the last 18 months, at least 129 ambulance attendants from across the United States have been accused of sexually related crimes on duty or off. In some cases, in a very press-like way to make it much more seamy and steamy and all those. It said that some of those actually occurred in the back of the ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
Here, and I will put this on the right track. I hope 129 cases or 129 attendants. Out of 900, the article says 900,000 people are employed as an EMT or are EMTs in the United States. That's 0.014%. I don't even know if that's like the pop. Is that greater than the population or is that less than the population? I wish they had made that analogy, but neither here nor there. I think it's a very bad thing. Don't get me wrong, but it just makes it seem like, you know, we're just a bunch of sex-crazed maniacs in the back of ambulances.
Hey, speak for yourself.
I mean, while that may be true, most of us try and control our impulses, though, and act them out only in an appropriate manner.
Well, amen, Skip. But I'm just saying that an article like this, you don't see it. Well, firefighters accused of stealing all kinds of things out of houses when they're in their...
Oh, if you haven't seen that, just you'll see that and more.
Well, I hope.
This is just what you call journalistic sensationalism. They get a story, they run with it. End of story.
I know. It's just.
On the other hand, interesting question. Let's take a look, and everybody on here has some experience with hiring, firing, and supervising EMS personnel. Let's go around and talk about what we do to make sure that the people we hire are of a character that we can entrust by themselves, unsupervised, with vulnerable patients in the back of an ambulance.
Okay, then you start.
I'll let somebody else start.
Well, Gary, do you know of any national movements or statewide movements where they actually have put a flag on people that will notify the state or the certifying body if something like this does happen?
Well, some states have laws that require... In Minnesota, we have a law that I'm sure this falls into the category that would require an ambulance service to report to the state EMS board. I think pretty much every state has a law for reporting for maltreatment of vulnerable adults, and usually those are dealt with and punished much more severely than what an EMS office would do to a, which is basically a certification change.
Yeah, I mean, most states in the National Registry will for sure jerk your license if you're convicted of an offense of that nature.
Well, not if you live in Texas, according to the article. Apparently, one of the 8 registered sex offenders that work as an EMT in Texas actually victimized a child. So that means 8. That just blows me away. That this is a field where you have to be in the back of an ambulance with people, and it's a most noble. I've said it before, and I'm not going to say it again. But here we are when people are the most vulnerable, and the state of Texas is allowing That just sickens me.
Well, okay, so I'll go off a little bit.
Go ahead.
I went to Texas A&M, and I took a wonderful course on major incident management. Had people from all the public safety and public health disciplines for a week in this giant simulation center, and I'll talk more about that program some other time. But I was assigned to a group for the week, and one of the guys in there was a police sergeant coming close to home from Colorado Springs, Colorado. And smart young man, had just come out of homicide, and was now he thought he might have aggravated somebody because he was now assigned to internal affairs for a 3-year tour. And one of the things their internal affairs officers were responsible for was background checks of potential applicants. So, you know, one evening sitting around talking, I said, "Okay, tell me about this background check stuff. When you're going to hire somebody to be a police officer, what's it involve?" And he walked through the process for me. And it was like nothing I'd ever seen in EMS, although I'd been on the other end of one a couple of times when I did other things in my career. But the Colorado Springs Police Department does a background check that involves someplace between 40 and 120 hours of a trained investigator's time to screen a candidate for employment. How much time does your EMS agency spend? Mine might spend 4 hours.
That sounds about right.
Right. So, let's see. We've got, okay, police officers compared to paramedics. Most cases, if a police officer wants to take your clothes off and search you beyond your outer clothing, presence of a supervisor is required. If you're of a different gender than the police officer needing the search, a officer of the opposite gender will be called. If a police officer wants to come into your house, typically they got to go see a judge and get a warrant. We do all those things as a matter of course every day with virtually no oversight.
Well, I will play a devil's advocate a little bit. Most of the time when we are in those situations, we've been invited in, versus a police officer where you don't really want a police officer coming in your home to quote-unquote find something, if you will. So there's a much different take there.
But besides the point, the question is, which occupational group is it more important to be trustworthy and of good moral character?
I don't think
I'll submit it's much more important for a paramedic.
I mean, it's important for both. It's important for both occupations, you know? But Chris makes a good point. I mean, it's completely different circumstances. You know, I don't want police officers coming in here, stripping me down, searching my house, and taking my guns. I mean, you know, that's just uncalled
for. None of us do, but that's not the point. The point is that, at least the point I'm trying to make, is that it is extremely important that the people we turn loose in the community to do what we do be of impeccable moral character, extremely trustworthy, and able to function in what is often a high-temptation environment, and not screw up. That means we don't put our hands where they don't belong. That means that the patient's controlled drugs always make it to the hospital with them. And that means that grandma's jewelry that was in the box by the bedside table while we were in the patient's room all remain there. And, you know, this is this article, but there's been articles on each of those other subjects in the not-too-distant past. And I'll submit that we just don't do the job that we should of screening our prospective employees.
Good part of that falls on the field training too, Skip. You know, I mean, you can do all the background checks in the world, and if you don't train your people to think, you know, this is our expectation of you, and if you're not at this level and if you're not doing this, for example, you know, you have a female patient and a male paramedic, grab a female EMT to come in here with you, have a witness, CYA on your end too, then, you know, a small percentage of it could be just not knowing any better and not thinking about it, you know?
Well, but in some cases you can't really have another female there if you're a male and vice versa. It's kind of the nature of the beast where, I mean, it would be not, in my ideal world, you would have a male and female on every crew. It'd just be easier. And I think it just adds a different dynamic, and it's just much more powerful, and maybe I sound like a sexist here, but I think it's very important to have both of those roles fulfilled on a scene. And I think that both genders bring something to that. I don't know, maybe that's just me. And it also helps when you're dealing with female issues as a male to have somebody else there with you, and vice versa. You know, it's the question that we'll probably be talking about 10 years from now, maybe on the EMS Garage, I don't know. But whether or not we can successfully filter out all of the people that shouldn't be doing wrong things, whether they're driving too fast, whether they're illegally, or they shouldn't be touching people in inappropriate manner, those type of issues.
I was just getting started there, Chris. going back to that process that gets used to hire a cop.
Right.
Psychological evaluation.
Right.
To determine, you know, and you know, often the use of the MMPI test to identify folks who have a predilection for stealing, lying, doing inappropriate sexual things and stuff like that. A 63-page background questionnaire, which I actually got physical possession of, the purpose of which is to set the stage for the polygraph examination. And then, and when they're all done with that, then they start with what they call the three-layer background check.
But Skip, we don't do that for nurses. We don't do that for doctors. And here we are at this crux of public service versus public safety versus healthcare. And we're not doing that kind of background check on nurses and doctors in most communities. And I will contend that we don't do those type of things in our field because it's not a career path. It's a job. And until we make it a career path, it's not going to change.
That's another show. I'm with you there.
Okay, all right.
Whether we should or not, you know, I'm not sure I agree with you, because the vast majority of the members of those other professions you describe do their work in institutional settings where there's people around all the time.
Good point.
Sure, they can close the door. But we're out and about, doing our work most often in groups of two, but also pretty often in groups of one.
All right, I will contend that that's a very good point. And boy, let's talk about this more. Maybe when we start talking with Aaron at the beginning of the year with the leadership NIMSMA podcast, we'll bring that in and maybe talk about how we can make a career path and how we would set that up. Maybe we could actually solve an issue here. Wow, that'd be excellent.
Hey Chris, a couple of points. There is a national practitioner data bank that that states can participate in when they take disciplinary action.
Can they, Gary? My thought, my understanding of the national practitioner data bank was just sort of a go or no go database if you've ever been kicked out of the Medicare program.
No, I'm sure Minnesota contributes to the data bank.
Could you send me the link and we'll put it on the Garage website?
I'll do that. And you mentioned Texas, and Texas actually does have significant disciplinary action that they take. I've sent you the web link to their page as well. There are scores of disciplinary actions in the last 2 years that are listed on their state EMS agency website.
Here's a North Carolina weirdism on that subject for you. Last year, the state EMS office advanced legislation to require a fingerprint-based criminal background check for everybody who's going to have an EMS credential. And it passed. But by the time it got passed, what it came with was a provision that says, yep, everybody has to get fingerprinted. The results go from the State Bureau of Investigation, which does the state and national fingerprint check, to the state EMS office, who may not disclose it to any employer or anybody else.
Yep, we have the same problem in Colorado.
So if the state finds out that a person has committed X transgression, then they have a disciplinary committee and they can deny, revoke, suspend, whatever, the license. But there's a decision-making process there. And let's say, just for example, they decide to let somebody be licensed, as I think we were talking about somebody did in Texas. They let somebody with an offense, a violation, a conviction, have a state license. That person's then free to, you know, with no further what have you, go out and go to work for people who may or may not, probably don't have a way to find out that that person, in fact, has a criminal record.
Well, they do. They can still, as an employer, you can still run a background check.
Oh, very limited. You certainly can't get into the National Crime Information System and find out somebody's been convicted in a bunch of other states.
I thought, well, at least in Colorado, you can go through the fingerprinting process, and you can own a flag in Colorado against a person within a database, because the state health department owns the flag of those fingerprints that they take. It just means that they have to go get re-fingerprinted when they become a part of you. They do it for teachers and a few other things in the state. So I know that we've had this conversation recently here. Now, nationally, I think I do agree with you. I don't know if there's a way to check that nationally.
I'm curious what they actually check on our background checks at the state level, because it's, you know, I've got other things I do that require background checks, and stuff comes up on those that doesn't show up on my EMS background check, you know?
Because you can't see your EMS background check in most cases, just like Skip was saying. The only people that are privy to that information is CBI or your local or your state Bureau of Investigation.
And no, but for example,
the people that request it.
My other background checks get flagged and I have to submit them with a cover letter in certain instances, but my EMS background check, this stuff never shows up. It's got a broader filter and it's not such a tight look.
What I'm telling you is it does show up, but the only people that see it are at the state, and then they're the ones that determine, like Skip was saying, they're the ones that determine whether or not they're going to call you and start an investigation. And then any time you're arrested after that, get a ticket, they know it, and they will call you. In fact, that has happened here recently in the state. In fact, it happens almost weekly here in the state, where an EMT or provider gets arrested for something. The employer may never know about it because it's probably in their off time or something like that, and the state will call them and say, hey, what was this about, or something like that. So I know several of the states on that, but this is neither here nor there. We'll talk about that later when we want to start talking about how we'll design the best leadership / career path for EMS in the future. But let's talk about the future of how we're going to deal with the up-and-coming generation in EMS. And I have tonight Joe Cavelli from EMS Responder, and he has been gracious enough to come on. They have started a new website, and Joe, I'm just going to let you go on and start talking about it and give us the inside scoop, if you will, about EMS United.
Great. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. We've been privileged here in the last 2 weeks to launch a new website, actually a social networking website called EMS United. It's accessible at emsunited.com. And I'm pleased to say within the first week of its launch, we're up to 800 members, and it's proven to be a very successful, innovative, and collaborative type venture. And we're very pleased to know about the number of members that have quickly joined on and used the opportunity to actually build the network as a member exchange opportunity. And really our whole concept with this was to make it a natural extension of the EMS Expo conference, so that our colleagues in the field in various positions throughout EMS, again throughout the world, have an opportunity to exchange ideas, participate in groups, launch forums and discussions, even post photos to their web you know, their member page 24/7, 365. So it's been a nice opportunity to get it started and offer something back to the business of EMS and the EMS professionals that they can use in their ongoing discussions, much like they do at the EMS Expo conference and networking and having fun and sharing ideas. So that's really the premise behind launching EMS United.
You know what I like about it, and it kind of reminds me of Facebook. I have to admit, when it first came out, I was like, I don't know if I want to join another social network, but I quickly became hooked because I'm a member of several listservs and other things, and you know, I even remember the days of bulletin boards and dialing in and, you know, reading the posts and the forums on there, but this just gives it a different sense. You see the people you're talking to, you can look at their photographs from where they're from, or you can even view videos, and it's very Facebook-like, but boy, I just like that it's only EMS, and it's very, very cool.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting you picked up on the Facebook, the model of Facebook, because really that was our intent with the design of EMS United. It was to make it a nice model. I mean, Facebook is a very successful social networking venture. It's proven very, very successful over the last few years, and we felt that was a very successful format, so let's utilize it as we look to build EMS United. It's not commercial in appearance at all, and again, we really designed this with the intent of member and member growth and just being a means of communication. It's been very interesting for us in the last week to really get a sense of what people want to talk about, what they want to exchange, what ideas they want to exchange, but just to see the good activity and the intent. And I have to say, I'm just memorized as I watch the photos flash on the screen. So, you know, when somebody accesses emsunited.com, you can look at the photos flash. It automatically loads 100 photos from all of our members, just randomly picks 100, and it's neat to see the activity out in EMS and to feel the passion and compassion of the industry. Leading into EMS Expo Conference, which was just held October in Las Vegas, one of the things we did was a photo contest. We received between 500 and 600 photos. And when we did the judging and the review of the photos, I had that same feeling. And so to now look at EMS United and to see how people are contributing in a large number, it's been very interesting to see EMS and really what EMS represents from so many different perspectives. I chatted with somebody today who just joined EMS United from Brazil, and to see the Brazilian EMS photos and to understand some of the things they're confronted with, it really has opened up an interesting forum, and that's why I hope people take a look at it, see really what it can be and how it can be used. And I have to say, for myself, I'm really not into that social networking, so not to say I've come into this with my feet dragging and kicking and screaming a little bit. I have in some respects, and my marketing department's been very good to get me clued in and up to speed. But it's been kind of fun to see how this thing has evolved so quickly. So
it's very cool. And I have to say, I only have about 70 friends, so everybody join. Everybody, you know, come be my friend. I need friends. I think Matt Solomon's not my friend, though. I just added him.
Well, so good.
There you
and
are.
You know, the
I
exciting...
You.
Yeah, there you go.
See, it's live. You're seeing it happen right now. So, Gary, you're on there. Skip's on there. Ben's on there. Now Matt. We're getting the EMS Garage on there. And we actually have a lot of track. We actually have a group on EMS United as well, which is very cool.
It's the United Garage.
Nice. I like it. Very cool.
Right.
Although my ranking as a group has dropped, so get me some activity. Go ahead,
well,
Joe. I'm sorry.
You know what? I was just going to say it's really neat to see the group activity start to develop. And not only is it state groups that are starting, you know, I mean, there's several that have been created through this, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and others. But it's nice to see individual services starting to use EMSUnited.com as a forum for their individual service, which would be kept within their service. You know, you have to be invited to the group to participate. But for individual ambulance services to use this as their gathering place and their forum is really a nice opportunity too.
So what do you guys think of it? What's your initial takeaway from it? Have you guys had a chance to look around and play with it?
Well, I have just found it's difficult to keep up with all of them now. You know, I spend a fair amount of time, as I have for years, keeping the NEMSMA list server active and interesting and educational, and now there's this one, and there's GEMS, and of course the garage generates an awful lot of email traffic. I'm not sure through any forum or whatever, but you know, I could probably spend 8 hours a day communicating with people on things of great interest.
That's right, and that's why you have to get on Twitter, Skip. That way, when you send something on Twitter, it goes to everything, and everybody's happy.
Oh my God, so nice. Drive people crazy.
One more thing you got to be involved in. You know, some of the cool forum topics that I really liked on EMS United. One was MVAs without FD, and people were like, "Can you believe that you would go to an MVA without the fire department?" And I think the main question was, they arrived on scene of an accident, and then they were querying the audience just to see, well, if you arrived there and the fire department wasn't there and the car was kind of smoking, would you get in there and help the people? And I wrote back, I said, well, I kind of remember the days when we did the extrication, and you just kind of, you know, the fire department never really showed up, so you just did it all. So I guess I didn't see the real question in there. You just kind of do your job and go with it. But, it's an interesting time where we're raising a generation of EMS folks that really have never been without the fire department or some type of specialized extrication team coming in to ensure that the car is safe before we hop in the car. So it's just interesting.
I got to say, I love the whole thing, the idea, and just kind of what I'm seeing here. Just it seems like this vast sort of melting pot of EMS from that perspective. You got everybody, all these great leaders in the field, and then just Joe Blow, the street medic, too, on there. And everybody's contributing and showing their stuff and throwing out their ideas, and they're, hey, isn't it crazy? These guys go and extricate people from cars without the fire department. And other people are going, yeah, we do. So I love it. I love seeing all the different views that are coming together on here.
Joe, are the comments that people really shared for us. You know, there really wasn't a place for people in EMS to go, and there was a lot of social networks that had been developed out there, but nothing really was meeting the interests of EMS specifically. And those are a lot of the positive comments that we've received. It's a great forum for people in common interest to share their EMS passion.
Well, this is a great idea, and you had some really neat ideas. Did you want to share them about what you're going to come up with, or are those really top secret, Joe?
Oh, really top secret. You know,
those are top secret. Okay.
This, what's interesting and what's fun about this is we can change it on the fly. Instantaneously, we can make design changes. We can incorporate new ideas. And really, that's where we're at. We'd like the members to continue to contribute to the content, to help share the message about EMSUnited.com, to come back and visit the site and encourage their friends and EMS colleagues to do the same. And we'd like to hear from people on their thoughts, other ideas, suggestions, things that they encounter on other websites that we can incorporate in the design that we've already, you know, that we have, and just continue to build the network so it's functional, easy to use, and it's member-friendly. And again, that's our whole intent with this. It's a forum. It's a platform for the members to use. We just want to be the advocate and the host and provide the place and the means and to have them take it from there.
Excellent. Well, what was really cool is after the first or second day after I joined, I received this email and it says Geek, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. Maybe people know me. And it was Brad, your geek from EMS United. He was saying, hey, I'm the geek, and just wanted to tell you, you know, we really like your podcast. And it was very cool. So
it's good.
He's a great guy, and he actually helped me with some tweaks I wanted to make to my own page, and he's been very, very useful. So
nice.
Make Brad your friend. Remember, geeks are your friend. So that's
yeah.
Good.
Brad's been very instrumental in the design and development of the site. He's our IT person internally, and he's very aware of what's going on. And he has some wonderful ideas. I mean, there's a lot more to come with this. So we're really just at the launch pad. It's out there now, and it will continue to change and evolve over time. And we'd like to thank the Garage for being a big part of it. You know, go to emsunited.com, and the Garage is right there with all the past podcasts.
Yeah, you guys featured us for last week. It was great. Yeah. I was very excited about that.
We did. We'd like to do some more stuff with you guys, too. So we'll definitely see what the future brings.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it. And we're going to really get to see more of EMS United and maybe how we can integrate more as a more interactive community. You know, we can make sure that we're all not in this this EMS journey alone.
Hey, Joe, I really like it too. The layout and everything is nice. I have one suggestion for you. I have a number of email addresses, and I use them for different things. And some of the other sites like Facebook and allow you to put in multiple ones and kind of choose where you have content sent to. This is limited to one email address, and so different people in my life get me based on which email address I advertise. So I put my work one in EMS United. It'd be nice to have a spot to put my home email address as well.
Okay, Gary, it's a good point.
And so, I know that they're kind of limited to the technology of the back end of that too. So
just right. We'll find out, and I'll let you know, Gary.
Good idea, though.
And I'm curious, Joe, what will you guys do in the future as this progresses to kind of keep the momentum and keep people interested?
There's so much technology out there that can be incorporated into the design, and we do have some limitations just on, you know, like Chris had mentioned, the background operation on it. But there's some things that we can incorporate, redesign, reformat, make more user-friendly. And I don't have anything off the top of mind, but really we're just looking for people to continue to contribute to it, let us know their comments, how they're finding the system work, other ideas that they might have. But that's really a question for our IT geek, Brad, to definitely answer. And maybe, Chris, he would be someone you'd like to invite to the Garage in a few weeks.
Yes, in fact, him and I have talked about having him on the show, but we're also trying to launch a new show coming in the new year, and I'm hoping to get him on that one as a regular.
That'd be good.
So we'll see. Yeah, it'll be fun. Because anybody that likes technology and is kind of a geek like me will probably like the show we're going to feature. We've done a couple test runs with a few people around the industry, and I know that there's definitely going to be some traction behind this. So it'll be. I've already got the domain name, and we're set. We've actually got two episodes in the can, and I keep saying this on every EMS Garage, but it'll come out. It'll be out soon. Just wait. Give me a little time. I don't have time for two podcasts in my life right now. Just one. So maybe next year.
Hey, Joe, what's up with Expo for next year? What kind of plans do you have? Do you have dates stuff yet?
We do. We actually just had our planning meeting today, so we're starting to lay the foundation for EMS Expo 2009. And the dates are October 26 to 30. It's going to be held in Atlanta at the Georgia World Congress Center. It'll be the 21st annual conference for EMS Expo. And we're coming off the heels of our Las Vegas show, which is always our biggest show. And so we're looking forward to being in Atlanta and reaching that eastern part of the U.S.
Joe, are you guys swapping coasts every year, or swapping ends of the country every year?
That's the typical track on it, just to, you know, do a change between East Coast, West Coast, and hit more of the popular destinations, too. It was kind of fun. We did a part of our post-show survey from the most recent conference was to ask people where they wanted to go, and it was kind of fun to see that San Diego was on the radar. Dallas was on the radar, Chicago was on the radar, other cities like that. So it really gave us a good background of where we can send the show in future years. But next year we'll be in Atlanta.
And I'll throw a pitch in for Denver some year too.
And I was going to ask if Minnesota in January was on your screen.
No, didn't quite make it, Gary.
Darn.
How about Aruba in January?
Right.
Joe, you guys have that other conference, the Fire World thing?
Firehouse, right.
Firehouse.
We have EMS at Firehouse in San Diego this February.
And so what is the EMS track like at that conference?
Well, one of the interesting things with Cygnus Business Media, which the exposition division is a part of, is in operating and having a few divisions to include Firehouse Magazine, EMS Magazine, and then also the conferences, Firehouse World and Firehouse Expo, and also the EMS Expo, we have some nice synergy there. And one of the questions we asked of our attendees at EMS Expo is, would you like to see an event that brought together both fire and EMS type classes? Really a nice crossover opportunity. And those that said extremely suggest or highly suggest would represent about 40 to 50%. And that we found is a very significant and important number. Basically, it's telling us that people want to see EMS and fire train together and have some synergies. And a lot of departments are running both fire and EMS. So that's why we developed the EMS at Firehouse World, which will be in San Diego, February 15 to 17, 2009. And it really is a forum where we'll have about 20 to 30 EMS classes and about 80 fire classes. And attendees can flip-flop between them based on their interest, need, continuing education requirements.
So the question that's popped up for me as I've kind of seen that advertised is for the non-fire EMS person, is that a place where the content is right, or is it more tailored toward the fire-based EMS market?
Well, it's really the EMS component is really tailored to the clinical person.
Okay, so it would be appropriate for pretty much anybody.
Yes, you know, somebody that's a firefighter, paramedic, a firefighter EMT, or a standalone EMT or paramedic, it's the perfect situation. And in challenging times and in sending someone to a conference costs money to go to. When you add travel, hotel, conference fees, it does get expensive. And we felt, given the economic times, this is the perfect situation for a dual-purpose conference. If you're a firefighter and you have EMT or paramedic certification as a part of your job requirement, you get the best of both worlds. You can attend the fire classes and attend the EMT or EMS classes and get credentialing. So it's really the best of the best, especially given tighter budgets, maybe limiting some of the conferences. This is both. This is both fire and EMS.
So the fact that it's EMS at Fire World or whatever it is shouldn't discourage someone who's not a fire-based EMS person from attending.
That's correct. It shouldn't discourage them at all, and in fact, it should encourage them. The EMS at Firehouse World is simply the branding of it. It's the Firehouse World Conference, which is the fire piece. The EMS at Firehouse World is simply the EMS piece, but there's a bridge between the two, and attendees can attend either one. If you're registering for the Firehouse World program, you can attend both the EMS and fire classes.
Cool.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Hey, no problem. Anytime you want to come on.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. You know, and I invite people to check us out at emsunited.com and feel free to add me as a friend, and we'll correspond further.
It's amazing the activity that's going on there.
And you need to blog more, Joe. I just want you to know that. more random thoughts throughout the day. Good idea.
All right, I'll work on that. That'll be my New Year's resolution, just for
you
Chris. 2009.
Perfect. And add EMS Garage at the end of everything you say, and then I'll be happy. It'll be perfect.
All right.
Hey, thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
So we also wanted to talk quickly tonight about, and maybe just introduce the idea of the ASEP conference or the ASEP. Sorry. Conference. I've got conference on the brain now. The ASEP report that came out today. Gary or Skip, would you like to introduce the topic?
I could jump in if you want.
Okay.
First of all, I'd like to preface the comments by saying ASEP has done a remarkable job with this thing. There is tons of information here. And so when I first saw it, kind of what started running through my head was, how could this apply to EMS? And first of all, I wanted to applaud ASEP for calling this the Emergency Medicine Scorecard and not the EMS scorecard. They are talking about a specific component of EMS, and so they chose to call it the component that they were actually talking about and not to confuse people about the larger system. But so I've been trying to think about how could this be done for other parts of EMS, and wondering about the way that they put some of this information together, where the sources come from, how they do the calculations. But particularly as I started looking through the information, one thing that kind of jumped out at me was the report appears to subscribe, at least in the measures that they've created, it appears to subscribe to the more is always better philosophy, because they tend to rank states higher for the more that they have stuff. So I was thinking about EMS a little bit. And I'm going to throw some comments out that may or may not be correct, and you may or may not agree with them. That's your choice. But we know that about on 75% of the calls, or less than that, one paramedic is necessary. And on 2% of the calls, cardiac arrest, two paramedics are necessary. And on less than a tenth of 1%, when RSI is needed, three are necessary. But we have a lot of EMS systems that involve the first response and ambulance part of EMS, where four or more paramedics routinely respond. So I wondered how they would score something like that. We've got a situation where some places set up 100% of the time of over-triage. And I know how people would react to that if we used air medical services that way. But for example, they have some measures in their report that have to, one I found interesting was nursing. And if you look at the national report card, the average number of registered nurses per 100,000 population in the country is 873. They show the best value, they've termed it the best value, at 1385, and the worst value at 560. So I'm just wondering, where does the point come where if you have too many of something, that starts to drive your score down? And so I'm hoping that they can comment about that a little bit for us. I'm also really curious about how they got some of this data, the sources they used. It would be difficult to do this in EMS, but I think it would be good for us to think about what data we have available or not, and the ability of states to actually participate should someone do it. And then the ambulance stuff is noticeably out of the report. For example, one of the things that I would have liked to have seen included in here was the waiting time that an ambulance has to drop off a patient. That would have been a great addition to this report. So I was kind of wondering if they left us out intentionally because of not wanting to tread on some turf kind of a things. One of the most interesting characteristics I found, though, was they have on the national report card, they have listed the numbers of lawyers per 10,000 population at 25.2, and then the number of board-certified emergency physicians they used 100,000 population and got 8.7. So I'm assuming that if they put those both at 10,000 population, the lawyers would be 25.2, and the board-certified emergency physicians would be at 0.8. And since we have a lawyer on with us, I don't know. I'd just rather have a lot more emergency physicians per 10,000 population than lawyers, and maybe Skip would want to comment on that.
No comment.
Hey, all I can... You bring up some interesting points, Gary, about them basically explicitly not including EMS. Are we ready for a report card like this in EMS? Do you think we'd be shocked if we did? Because we really don't have a national body that would, at least in my view, that has the traction that ASEP or something like that does, that can really come in and take a true look at what we do in EMS and score us. Do you think that...
I'm not sure. One of the things that when I looked at this is a very interesting and complex and a lot of hard work went into the study, but it's clearly though advocacy on the part of emergency physicians. Now this isn't a scientific study, And a couple of your comments pointed out that, you know, there's no sense that the scale they used actually reflects value to the citizens. This is trying to capitalize on the credibility of physicians and say, you know, hey, if we say this is bad, it must be bad. Let's do something about it. So it is, you know, it's not a scientific paper. It's a political statement. You know, that being said, it's probably a good one. If you've got the tools, you might as well use them.
And I think
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that we have the tools, but maybe we ought to go use them anyway.
Well, was that what NEMSIS was designed for? Maybe to start really studying this?
No, NEMSIS is a patient database. You know, at its heart, it's going to study all the things that we study in terms of, you know, epidemiology and treatments and yada yada. It would be interesting to, for example, you know, NHTSA for years has had a process whereby they survey state EMS systems and compile pretty credible reports for the state of their own system. It would, you know, it might be interesting to round those up and summarize them as to what, you know, these series of expert panels using a set of agreed upon benchmarks had to say about the EMS systems in each state. It might be more inside baseball than the ASEP report is, but the fact that some professional group in emergency medicine has undertaken to educate the public about the state of emergency medicine is a wonderful thing, and we could probably benefit from it.
I agree with you, Skip, that the NHTSA state assessments would be a really valuable tool and might even be the best starting point. One of the other things that I thought about as I read through this, the Institute of Medicine report that came out a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. really had a heavy emphasis on regionalization. So as I think about Minnesota's report, which I printed off, the eastern side of St. Paul is less than 10 miles from Wisconsin, and so from a regional perspective, the region of the Twin Cities really covers part of Wisconsin, and I wonder how those kinds of issues are dealt with, and it might be actually cool to take to heart the Institute of Medicine's report and trying to emphasize regionalization and actually come up with a definition of regionalization and perhaps have a similar kind of report that talks about how emergency medicine looks from a regional perspective rather than a state perspective. There's a lot of places like the Twin Cities where state boundaries are crossed by an urban area. Especially, we've got several just in Minnesota between the Dakotas and Wisconsin. But our numbers probably don't show up in Wisconsin. Don't have an impact on what it shows for Wisconsin, even though the bulk of the patients from near St. Paul on the Wisconsin side get their health care in Minnesota.
Well, and here's another question. Not only do you think we're ready for it as EMS, but are we mature enough to handle the results?
Well, that's a good question. An awful lot of the EMS community spends a lot of time bemoaning its fate. Even honest, objective criticism does not seem to be very well received.
This is very true.
You know, if just to make up some terms, you know, if somebody graded the state of Wyoming poorly, we might have a sit-in on the next show from the rural EMS providers of Wyoming who thought they were taking a whooping.
I agree with you. In EMS, we tend to be, to use a coined term, Minnesota nice, and don't spend enough time talking about where we could use some improvement, and underestimate the value of having our challenges broadcast, which many times can improve our lot in life.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of folks who, you know, look at how we go out and try and do good in our community. Therefore, nobody should ever say we're anything less than wonderful.
So one of the values about this report is that it is statewide, and it talks about a whole state and doesn't identify a specific entity.
But that's also one of the disservices of it as well.
Correct.
And I agree with you, Skip. You made a really good point, Skip, that if you were not mature enough to take it, but at the same time, we are way too nice about things that really need to change in our industry. And I honestly don't think we're ready for something like this. However, let me ask you this. Who's the professional body in our industry that could do something like this? Because I don't think I don't think that as an industry, because that public safety piece doesn't fit in there, we're not politically savvy enough sometimes as an industry, Minnesota excluded, that we understand that a bad report could mean more dollars. That actually could be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we're like, ooh, let's cover that up because we don't want people to know that we can't respond to things. They need to know that when they dial 911, it's all good, even though we're burning people out and tomorrow we're not going to have a system. But today we have one, and just very short-sighted. And I hope that as an industry we can change that. Am I off base? Or?
I think we have a couple of organizations that would be reasonable to take a shot at those. Had an initial look at this thing. One would be NEMSMA. Another might be the North Central EMS Institute. Another might be one of the universities that has a specialty in EMS research, or maybe some combination of those organizations. I think it would be cool for somebody to take a first shot at it.
I would love to see it, and I would love to be a part of it. And I think that it's something that I would love to talk to the docs that are coming on next week had a huge stake in this process and are really going to be able to dive into I don't want to get too numbery next week because that really takes away from our conversation. I really want them to explain a lot of the thought process behind it and for goodness sake, why the lawyers per 10,000 population, the range. Did you see that? 496 was the high per 10,000 people. You could
well, and
that?
and that's where there's. I mean, that's purely a political statement. If your state doesn't provide special protection to emergency physicians, it is bad. And if it does provide special protection to emergency physicians, it's good. You know, there is no evidence that I've ever seen that says that having the threat of civil litigation hanging over your head is bad for you or is good for you. Being very cynical about that, it says that we think the public is better served if emergency physicians cannot be held legally accountable.
Now, here's two questions for you, Skip. Do you think that they timed this, A, because they knew Barack Obama was going to announce his pick for HHS today, and B, I think maybe we need to look at it for what it is. The very first page is all about medical liability and the medical liability environment. Is it basically a shot across the bow at tort saying we need to reform this puppy because after a while we're not going to be here?
Well, I don't think it's it's timing related to Obama. I think they do this time every year.
Okay.
But you know, clearly one of ASEP's organizational goals is to gain tort liability protection for their members. And like I said, if you got the tools, you might as well use them.
I have that goal for EMS as well.
Oh, I like that goal.
I share that goal.
Excellent. Ben, you've been quiet tonight. What's up? Just soaking it all in or out on a call?
Yeah, pretty much just kind of soaking it all in. This is some pretty good discussion going on.
All right, great. Well, I wanna hold us here because we're right at about an hour and 10, and I wanna keep it at that hour and 10 because people can still burn it to their CD and play it in their car if they don't own an MP3 player. Thank you guys very much. Gary, what are you up to this week? You're heading to DC again?
Yeah, I'll be in DC again next week, and then I've got like a whole week at home, so I know a few days after getting home, Karen and the twins will start asking when I can leave again.
Oh, man. Oh, wait, but aren't you going to Hawaii?
Yes, then the four of us are going to go to Hawaii, and hopefully I'll join you for the New Year's podcast from Hawaii.
I think it'd be fun. I want to try and do the New Year's Day podcast. Hopefully you all aren't too hungover from your night before, but maybe we can just do a quick 30-minute, 40-minute podcast that day just to... I have an idea for the New Year's podcast. Let's look back a little bit on the previous year in EMS, and then let's take a look into the future for 2009 and give our predictions and see how good we're going to do. So it'll be a fun podcast for the very first day of the new year and start us off right, and we'll go from there. Joe, what are your plans for the holidays? You guys doing anything?
Sorry about that.
Oh, there he is.
Sorry,
hey, Joe.
That, Chris, I'm here. I was just...
Hey, no problem.
Hey, you know what? We always get together with family and friends, so that's how we do it.
Nice. And it's
don't
the right
have
time
any plans for travel or anything.
Oh, well, enjoy your holiday.
Same
Skip,
ball.
How about you? You heading anywhere fun?
Nope, we're doing Christmas and New Year's at home, and my parents-in-law are coming down for a few weeks, and they come down and spend Christmas and New Year's pretty much every year with my wife and my two daughters, and we have a real good time because we don't get to see them as often as we'd like to.
Oh, very nice. That's great. And Ben, are you celebrating Festivus this year, or are you going for Christmas?
Well, it's a little of both. I have a Festivus pulled up at my apartment, and then I'll go with my parents and the rest of the family down in the Front Range, and we do the traditional Christmas down there.
Nice. I want to take out my grievances with you before the day. And then Matt said he had to run. He wishes us all well, and he will join us again next week. So thank you guys very
Chris,
much for joining us. Yes, go ahead, Ben. Go ahead.
We never heard what your holiday plans are.
You know, just hanging out with family and friends like everybody else. And really, this year I'm gonna thank sit around and thank my family for just being here and for just one more year of really understanding that A, I have a job, and I'm very thankful for that, and B, that we work in probably one of the best professions in the world. So those are some of the things I'm going to be doing around Christmas, and drinking a little eggnog and opening a lot of presents and ordering my new iPod because I lost mine. And if you find it on a Southwest jet somewhere in the United States, just remember that's mine, and tell me thanks when you're listening to The Garage. So thank you guys very much, and we'll see you next week.